Today on Peace Talks Radio, our guest is Hilary Anger Elfenbein, professor of organizational behavior at the Olin Business School, who is known for her research on emotion in the workplace and negotiation. Tell me about your research on individual differences in negotiation. What have we learned from this work?
So when I first showed up in this topic area, there was a real dominant perspective from academics that people are the rational, so-called the rational man, and that in a negotiation, it didn't really matter of differences from one person to the next. And I think that the common wisdom is really quite the opposite. There's a lot of sense among people outside of academic circles that that certain personalities are more typical of successful negotiators. So the common wisdom would be people who are more assertive, people who are more confident, people who are more extroverted. They enjoy interacting with other people. And people who are maybe more conscientious are able to better prepare. So there's this clash, or there was this clash, between what the academics thought and what most people thought. And I really tend to favor common sense hypotheses in general in psychology as being worth testing before dismissing them. And so I looked around and said, you know, my favorite kind of research is to imagine you know nothing about the academic research side of things and say, mm-hmm. what would I do if there were absolutely nothing done on this topic and starting from scratch? And so the work that I did basically started by saying, let's be open and take pretty much every personality trait we can think of and just see whether people who endorse those traits were better at the kinds of experiential exercises that that researchers tend to use for our paradigms. It's very hard to measure success in negotiation. It's really hard because I can't send a lot of people out to buy cars and then find out how well they did. And if I ask people about the cars they bought, I don't know as a researcher what the right answer was. So we have people do these experiential exercises and voila, a lot of the common sense notions tend to be correct on average.
So the regular person kind of had a better sense of this than the academics, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And I think it's because the research in this topic was really dominated by economists who have a certain perspective on how people actually behave that doesn't necessarily correspond to the way that psychologists see people actually behaving.
Okay, okay. What kind of exercises were people involved in the research doing?
Sure. So I might give half the people in the study a set of instructions to be a buyer and half the people to be a seller, and then put them together and see what they come up with. So they would have instructions, for example, typically in these studies, there'll be 5 to 8 issues. So they might be negotiating, and it's fictional exercise, right? It's a role play. They're trying to put themselves in the role. And they might be making a decision together about the price of the car, the color, the warranty, these kinds of topics, the delivery date, and they would the luxury feature. So they would have 5 to 8 issues that they have to reach an agreement on. And some of these issues are completely competitive, like price. Obviously, you want to buy low and sell high. Mm-hmm. But then some of the other issues are less obvious. So in one example, they actually want the same delivery date. They want a delay. The car dealer would like to order something rather than use up their stock. And the purchaser is about to go on vacation and rather would take delivery afterwards. So there are issues where you don't realize that actually you have compatible cooperative preferences. And then there are issues that are trade-offs where maybe we both care about the warranty, but one side cares a lot and the other side cares only a little bit, and you see whether people can make efficient trades. So those are the kinds of exercises people do. And typically the outcome is really twofold. So there's the objective score they reach, because these are all scored. They know for the issues how many points they're gaining. But then also a colleague of mine, Jared Kurhan from MIT, the two of us created a survey about the feelings people have coming out of their negotiations. And we would also, and I feel like the field has moved to a point where other people are really heavily using this survey as well. We'll also measure coming out of this, how did you feel? And there are huge personality differences in that. More agreeable people tend to feel like they've had a better experience working with others. More neurotic people tend to feel like they've had a more negative experience working with others. It's not surprising because neuroticism at its core is about being sensitive to the negative signals of life. And negotiations is really negative for a lot of people. Actually, Jared has this study, not something I was involved with, but he did a survey where he asked people about life activities. So just people on the street, he just asked them, here's a set of life activities. How much do you enjoy them? And they were things like going to the movies, eating at a restaurant, doing chores. Well, negotiating ranked lower than going to the dentist.
That's probably true for me.
People don't enjoy this. This is not a fun activity for most people. A very small number of people love it. For most people, it's a chore.
How did you measure the personality traits like agreeableness or neuroticism? Was there some kind of a personality survey or tool that was used beforehand?
Absolutely. So in the research on personality, the dominant paradigm is self-report, and people are pretty reliable. And by reliable, these kinds of surveys have been validated with respect to close people to them also rating them. So the kind of validation studies, the people you're closest to would rate your extroversion, and then you would rate your extroversion. And the researchers have shown historically that these correspond really highly to each other. So it's valid to just ask people outright to endorse personality traits for themselves.
Okay. And then do we know now, is it possible to say what personality traits good negotiators have?
Yeah. So the answer is it depends on the kind of negotiation. And there are so many different features, but I'll put them into two main buckets, which are cooperative and competitive. Also, you might phrase these as long-term versus short-term. Short-term is what, in general, people think of. Like when I say negotiation, people think of buying a car. They think of buying a house. They think of job negotiations. And those are often, especially buying a car, it's a one-shot deal. And especially buying a new car, you don't even need to trust them because you can lie all you want, but I'm buying a Subaru. It's a new Subaru. The company Subaru is going to stand behind it. I might think that I can't trust you at all, but you're not the person I'm dealing with 2 years from now. Those are the kinds of negotiations where assertiveness and extroversion are really valuable for that. Assertiveness, do you feel comfortable putting yourself forward and advocating for your needs? So those are the short term. Those are negotiations in particular where your interests are pretty well at odds with each other and you don't have a long-term relationship with the person. So that's the kind of negotiation where the general stereotype really does apply. But then you have the long-term negotiations where high-quality working relationships and implementation really come into play. Now, I live in St. Louis, Missouri right now. I'm from New York City originally, but I live in St. Louis, which is what I would call an old economy. So people in St. Louis make physical objects. Or their companies that control the creation of physical objects, and so we have Boeing, the former McDonnell Douglas, all the defense contracting. Those are our physical objects made here. We have Anheuser-Busch with beer. We have Emerson Electronics. Now these are the kinds of companies. Boeing's a great example where they will have many years long contracts. Because if you are making a specialized part for a fighter jet, they don't want to just, you can't just buy those. No one's just making those. You have to contract for someone to partner with you to make exactly the thing you want. Those are negotiations where if you're just a gunslinging, assertive person, that's a terrible personality fit.
Okay.
Because you're trying to create a working relationship that's going to weather the storms of implementation. You know, if you don't feel like somebody's going to come through for you 3 years from now, that's not a good deal. So you can see how that's the kind of context where you want somebody who's agreeable, who's a good listener who can build trust. So I think of those as the two main buckets. You know, there are a lot of criteria we could use that distinguish in one negotiation from the next. But if you think about those as two main buckets, they require completely different personality traits.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What about negotiations that are more coercive or high stress, like hostage situations? Where would that fall in this continuum?
So hostage negotiations in particular are fascinating about the kinds of traits that are necessary in the in the in this high stress, high stakes moment. And the work that I've done in this area has really been about the teams, not about just the individuals, but the teams, because these are large teams working together with a very distinct set of roles. And the big aha looking at these kinds of roles, and I'm happy to list a few of them, is that people need strong emotional intelligence. And if you could just say, I have one trait I'm going to select for to do this job well, it's about emotional skills. And it's such a high stress job that the lead negotiator actually has a secondary negotiator who is equally skilled. They might actually take turns. The primary and the secondary might take turns from one incident to the next. They're equally skilled. But the secondary, their job is to support the primary, not just to bounce ideas, but literally to be there as an emotional support because of the extreme stress that it's hard to imagine a more stressful job.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely it is. Could you tell me more about these emotional skills? Are there specific traits that people look for this job?
Absolutely. So it's first helpful to explain a little bit about emotional skills. So emotional intelligence, something that most people have heard of, is really an umbrella of multiple kinds of trait of skills. So it's not just one skill. It's like saying it's like talking about intelligence. So IQ has a number of different pieces to it. It has math, it has spatial reasoning, it has verbal, and likewise, emotional intelligence has that set of, it's an umbrella of different skills. For looking at hostage negotiations, it's helpful to distinguish a bunch of skills. One of them is emotion recognition. Can you recognize the emotional states of others? This tends to be tested by showing people photos of facial expressions or audio recordings of vocal tone, and you ask people, what was this person trying to convey? And some people do better on these tests than others. And it's the first primary skill that you look at, and you say, the lead negotiator, really everyone on the team, but especially the lead negotiator, has to be alert to emotional transitions. So at some point, the hostage taker starts to be open. At some point, to a conversation. At some point, they suddenly get angry. When you first start speaking to them, what's their state of mind? Are they stable, unstable? Can you have a conversation with them? Do you need to calm them down first? There's a sense in hostage negotiation that you're constantly trying to buy time, that you need to delay. You want to get into conversation. Sometimes the goal of the conversation is really to delay long enough for the SWAT team to get in place. So, are you somebody who can tell what is the emotional state of this person? So, how can I best approach them in conversation? So, that's a big one. The other really big one is emotion regulation. Can you stay calm? And people vary. People vary in how calm they can stay, and it's usually an asset in life. But there are some jobs where you don't need that, and as much. And those kinds of jobs are jobs where you tend to be alone. So somebody who's in a technical area doesn't necessarily have to be very good at holding in their emotions, because they may not be in a situation where somebody would be negatively affected by an outburst. So that those are the two biggest ones. But then there's another big one is how good you are at managing the emotions of other people, right? We can never control other people. We can never control what other people feel. But some people are better at massaging that, right? Some people are better at soothing others. So a clinical psychologist would be excellent at that. Right, soothing others. Some people are good at energizing others. Some people are good at making other people angry, which is a skill if you wanted it, right? So like a sports coach wants to get their team riled up and angry, and are you effective at doing that? And that's a skill that the lead negotiator absolutely needs, because first of all, they got to calm that person down. First step
Sure.
is calm them down to the point where they can actually have a conversation with each other. And then they also lead negotiator n negotiator wants the a hostage taker to feel fear. you know, I have things I can give you, but you should be afraid if you're not cooperating with me. Cooperating with me is better because you should fear the alternative. A great hostage negotiator is really good at those three things, right? I can read the room. That's the emotion recognition. I can keep a hold of my own emotions because they're not happy with these people, right? But they have to treat the people. They're deep down inside. They're really upset that somebody would risk human life, right? But they have to stay calm. And then can they help persuade? Can they help induce emotions in the other person? So those are three really big ones. And it's hard to imagine an effective hostage negotiator who doesn't have super strong skills.
I spoke with Thomas Olson, who was held for an extended time by the Nusra Front in Syria, as well as Sue Williams, who's a crisis management consultant who used to lead the hostage crisis negotiation unit with the British police. And both of them really emphasize the importance of empathy and honesty in negotiating with people who are holding hostages. And they both kind of said, you know, that it's really important for you to try to understand where they're coming from and try to understand what got them to the place they're in. Even if we automatically think of these people as bad guys, you know, trying to really empathize with their situation. And I wanted to ask you, are empathy and honesty always the best strategy, or are there times when a more strategic or manipulative approach is better?
That's a great question. And I would actually say, and because empathy has three components. And I think you always need the first one. And then the second and third, you may sometimes want or not want, usually probably not want in a hostage situation. So the first layer of empathy is perspective taking. Can I see the world the way you see the world? Can I understand through your eyes? And that is 100% always helpful, always, because I can't work with somebody. I can't buy a car from somebody. I can't stand someone down from murdering another person if I don't understand how they got to this moment, what they want. What do I have to give this person that's valuable to them? What resources are not valuable to them? What would it take to upset them? What would it take? How can I give them something that they want? That's that first layer. And you absolutely need that every single time. Then the second and third layers are where sometimes it would be helpful, sometimes not. So the first layer is, do I know how you see the world? And the second layer is, do I care? And the third layer is, am I going to do something about it? And that's where I actually think in general, the hostage negotiator really wants to block out numbers two and three. Because, you know, you're holding 20 people in a bank. I don't want to sympathize with you. I want to understand you. I want to know what will it take to get you to walk out with your hands up. But I don't want to feel, I don't want to care how you feel. I have a job to do, which is to get you the heck out of there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Joining us today on Peace Talks Radio is Dr. Hilary Anger Elfenbein, Professor of Organizational Behavior at the Olin Business School. Hilary Anger Elfenbein is known for her research on emotion in the workplace and negotiation. Is it possible to develop these skills or these traits if you don't naturally have them? How can someone, you know, improve their ability to negotiate if I am not naturally agreeable or naturally good at reading emotions?
This is a great question, and it gets at the definition of personality. So personality is thought of by academics as your preferred way of being. So there's your behavior over time, and your personality would be kind of your average across times. And what I love about the power of that definition is that it says personality isn't destiny. So an extrovert tends to go to parties more than an introvert, but an extrovert doesn't spend their entire life at parties. They're at parties more often, but they're also making a choice. Every time they go to a party, it's a choice. And that's where we can actually dig into that and say, you know what? An introvert can force themselves to go to a networking event, right? They can force themselves. They may not enjoy it, but they also may have coping mechanisms like, I will go to a network event as an introvert with at least one person I know. And that's what you can do with some of these personality traits in negotiation. So I may be going into a negotiation where I need to be assertive. And maybe I'm not an assertive person naturally, but at that moment, being assertive is a choice. So my general tendency, if you took the average over my entire last 2 months, may be not very assertive. But that's a distribution I can draw from and say, this is a moment where I'd like to make a different choice about how to behave than my natural tendency would encourage me. And I think if you think that way, you say, like, you know what? You don't actually have to change your personality. You don't. And in fact, we need to embrace our personality. It's incredibly hard to change. The genetics research shows that personality is largely 50% genetic. A baby is born introverted or extroverted in a way that corresponds years later to the way that that young person behaves. It's actually hard to change it. And I would also advocate, by the way, that you don't want to, because it's your authentic self and you should embrace your authentic self, but you don't need to be that authentic self every single minute of the day, right? When you go into a car dealership, just choose to behave more assertively. And there are techniques, and we do in coursework about what are the things you can focus on that help you be more assertive. And just the spoiler is, if you do your research about what the market standard is for whatever it is you're negotiating, it makes you more assertive, because instead of framing it as I'm asking for things, you frame it as I am making sure I'm treated fairly. And I have a piece of paper where I've run numbers to determine what is the fair market of this car, of this salary. And it makes people much more assertive, because they're not thinking that they're demanding anything. They're thinking that I'm expecting in life to be treated fairly, and here's what fairness looks like.
Are there any other techniques that you could mention?
Well, with empathy, some people are better able to imagine what other people are going through, but it's also a choice to sit down and brainstorm it. So a lot of times people, when they're negotiating, they've really been focused on their own perspective. What do I need? What are my numbers? You know, at what point do I walk away because I have a better alternative? And what people don't often think as much about, and at least in my courses, it's this aha moment, is I should run the same analysis for my counterparty. So what is it I'm trying, you know, I'm negotiating over a job offer, and I know what the fair market is, and I know what I would do if this deal falls through. I would take this other job instead. Well, a lot of people don't make that second step and say, well, what would the employer do if I don't take the job? And maybe it's a job market where they have 100 people applying. Then you realize, okay, well, I need to approach this differently than if I'm the only one who really has this skill set. Then that will change. But it's a choice. It's some people are better than others at figuring that out, but it's a choice to actually sit down and try.
Yeah. Is this different in negotiations that are like more emotional, or so like buying a car or negotiating a salary? These are like kind of transactional negotiations, but I'm thinking of like negotiations with family members about, you know, highly emotional issues like disagreements over family plans or over COVID restrictions or something like that. Are there different techniques or different skills that would come into play in that sort of setting?
Absolutely. The first thing is to realize that when a situation is highly emotional, and I would phrase it as a highly activated situation, we tend to fall back into dominant responses. So if I say, you know what, I'm gonna work harder at taking the other person's perspective, just to realize that's a little harder to do when the situation is highly activated, because I'm gonna fall back in to not thinking that way. If I'm training myself into that, it's easier to train yourself into a new behavior when the stakes are lower, when you're less feeling less intense. So first, just to realize that, but negotiating the ones you described, so high stakes, there's the hostage negotiation example where there's high stakes, but it's not a long-term relationship. And then what you were just saying about family, that's high stakes, but there is a long-term relationship. And I think in the latter case, the long-term nature is where you really can dig in, because you can try to have those conversations in a calm way in advance, if you can anticipate them in advance. So who's doing chores? That can get very aggravating for couples, right?
Yeah.
Who's picking up the kids? Who's doing this? Who's making dinner? However, those are upsetting at the time. They're activated at the time, but you actually could, when life is calm, say, let's work these out at this moment. And so the fact that it's a long-term relationship actually gives you the opportunity to have those negotiations when you aren't in a stressful, high-stakes moment.
So is it useful then to like take a pause and say, let's come back to this tomorrow, or, you know, let's take a break until we're calmer?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're upset with somebody negotiating over chores, it's not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Hillary Anger Elfenbein, how important are expectations in negotiations? If I go into a negotiation expecting to lose, then am I more likely to have a bad outcome?
Absolutely. The very most influential work on individual differences in negotiation actually looks at attitudes, chronic attitudes. So some people feel more empowered and some people feel less. Some people actually, a really great area is about your beliefs about negotiation. Is this a skill that can be learned, or are some people just better at it than others? And if all you do is give people a brief survey about that, you'll see that the people who think it's learnable work harder. They do better, and they do better because they're literally just working harder. They're taking longer. They're preparing more. And so your beliefs are incredibly important. My other favorite, so this is again Jared Curhan, my colleague from MIT, he created a scale called appropriateness, and it's this hilarious scale. There's just one question. How appropriate is it to negotiate over price at the following establishments? And it starts out reasonable enough, like flea market, used car dealership, but then it starts to get weird, like L.L. Bean, the grocery store, and my favorite one is the gas station. And no one has ever negotiated over the price of gas at the gas station that I've ever met. But that's not the question. The question isn't, would you do it? The question isn't, do you think it would work? The question is, do you think it's appropriate? And some people say one. It's a scale of 1 to 7. Some people say one, but some people say two. The people who say two are very different people. And if you just take the average of all of this, these people do better in the kinds of experiential exercises we give. And, you know, the reason is because they're more confident. And this is where nervousness comes in. Being nervous in a negotiation is never a good idea. It's never helpful. And when I say good idea, it's not like you choose to be nervous.
Yeah.
But it's never helpful, because if somebody cares about you and they feel and you're nervous, then through sheer emotional contagion, they're uncomfortable too.
Okay.
But if somebody doesn't care about you and they detect you're nervous, now they're the shark smells blood.
Sure. So would this be like a fake it till you make it situation, where if you pretend that you're more confident and that you think you're going to do well in this, and then that will help you?
The best way, and I wouldn't really call it faking it, is to do your homework, do your research, walk into that negotiation knowing what's fair. And what's fair would be defined as, in general, what does this transaction yield? So fair market for a salary would be what this job tends to pay in this area of the country. And that, when you walk in with that, it's not really faking it, because you're walking in with the mindset of this is what fairness looks like. But the other thing you do is practice. Practice makes confidence. And so actually in my class, I have some people do something called the negotiation gym. And the idea is that this is a muscle. You can exercise it. So you build confidence, not by faking it, but you build confidence by small wins. I send my students out into the world to negotiate over things they wouldn't normally negotiate over. And they do things like they call up their credit card company. So they call up the phone company. They call up any kind of vendor they have. And they just say, hey, can you cut the price of my alarm system? Can you, they go shopping and they ask for discounts on products they would buy. And this is really nerve-wracking, But you do it where there's low stakes and you do it politely. So I have examples of questions. So you don't walk into Macy's and demand a discount. You walk into Macy's and you say, are there discounts you can offer? And you walk in, you're buying jewelry, and you say, what kinds of promotions do you have going on? Or is this the best price you can give? And you know what? If they say this is the best price you can give, then you say, all right, well, I learned the answer to that. And what I tell people in class is that you need to get comfortable with no if you're going to get to yes. And so you walk in, for people who are nervous enough, actually the one I start with, and my friends who are in the restaurant industry always tell me they hate this, which is why it's a good one to do, is walk into a restaurant and whatever table they show you, say you'd like a different table and offer no explanation.
Okay.
And they're going to tell me. And they'll say sometimes, you know, well, that table doesn't have a server or that table's taken, but you actually want to have no said to you so that you realize, oh, the world doesn't crumple. I don't crumple into a heap of sadness if someone says no.
Right. Okay. I see. So it's not about the trying to get to the yes in that case. It's about accepting the no.
It's about both. It's about both.
Okay.
Because you need to have no said to you so that you realize no isn't the end of the world. And you need to have yes said to you so that you celebrate the small wins and build confidence. And you just keep trying. And you you don't become annoying trying to negotiate over everything. And by the way, I teach this for a living. I'm very cautious about when I even negotiate. I save it for when it matters. You don't nickel and dime people over every little thing.
Okay,
but you save it for when it matters. But you get people trying, and that's where, you know, you were asking fake it till you make it. I would say rather practice it until it's natural.
Okay. I mean, I could ask you questions all day because this is really fascinating, but I know that we've gone over time, and I think this is everything that I really wanted to include here. Is there anything I've missed or that you really want to mention?
Yes, and this gets back to the hostage negotiators. Mm-hmm. I'll phrase it in a way where you can splice it back in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When we talk about the importance of emotional skills, emotional intelligence for negotiators in the hostage situation, I want to emphasize that not everyone on the team needs every single emotional skill. So I wrote a paper I called Emotional Division of Labor. And so the primary negotiator needs basically every single skill. But then there are people on the team who don't. So the recorder is an example of somebody who needs to be very good at reading the room, because they're not just writing down the words, they're writing down the emotional transitions, what they're noticing. But they don't, for example, need to influence other people's emotions because they're really just recording things. And then you have people like the tactical team. So the commander of the tactical team needs to be very good at recognizing others' emotions and understanding perspective taking. But the sniper is fascinating, by the way. The sniper does not need to be good at expressing their emotions, influencing others' emotions, because they're not doing that, right? They're silent. A good sniper has excellent emotion recognition skills and excellent self-regulation, because they're there for hours. They're there for hours taking aim at somebody who's they're pretty angry at, right? They're not happy with this person, but they're taking aim, and they need to stay calm. They need to keep their attention up, and they need to be good at recognizing the emotions of the person they're aiming at. Because when that person is calm, the sniper has a different job than when that person is highly activated. So the sniper is an example of somebody who, you know, I mean, the primary negotiator needs every single skill that's out there, but other people on the team, like the sniper, they need two skills really, really good at, and the other skills really are irrelevant to them. And what's neat about this, and this is actually a kind of happy ending, is that emotional intelligence, you know what, you can develop it, but a lot of people are born with better than worse, and early childhood is formative. So as an adult, it's very hard to say, I'm going to move the needle entirely and improve. It would be like saying, I'm going to move the needle on spatial reasoning. But the happy part of this idea of division of labor is that everyone doesn't have to be good at everything. Right? Some people are better at math than others. Some people can't run in a startup team. Some people can't run the numbers, and they aren't running the numbers. You've got your creatives. You've got different people doing different things in general in the work life. And I find it really reassuring that if your emotional intelligence isn't where you want it to be, figure out ways for other people to complete you.
So it's really about finding the team that complements one another.
Yes.
Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to mention? Because again, I'm conscious of your time. I don't want to take.
That's the really big stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. This was excellent. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And I really enjoyed talking to you.